of anyone. Okay, then let's start. Okay, I think this was the slide where we left off last. So first of all, let me introduce to you Shima. She's your instructor for the exercises. Yeah, so you will get to know her on Friday. Regarding the exercises, I requested accounts for the HPC systems here in Erlangen, which you should hopefully receive by Friday. If not, does every one of you have a account on the SIP pool computers? Okay, so perfect. So that's at least something where we can start off then, if the accounts don't arrive in time. Okay, perfect. So any other questions? Right. So I exported your account names from Studon, and sent them to the service center, and they will hopefully.
If I haven't registered in Studon,
then you won't get an account. And you won't get any updates, and you won't get the slides if you haven't registered.
Today, today we'll register, but the question is, can I register today and then have account?
Sure. Please write me an additional email.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay. So you won't get missed. Okay. Any other questions? Did everyone else register on Studon? Okay, perfect. I think I have 45 people or something there. Okay. I hate this. Sorry. For some reason. Okay. So then let's start. So this is where we left off, and I hope you still remember the instructions, right? How they approximately look like, right? So those instructions that we see here in assembly form are very basic instructions, right? So move instructions, add instructions. Those push and pop instructions are a little bit special. But yeah. They're mostly for entering functions and leaving functions. But anyway, so regarding those instructions, what we one classification to classify the complete instruction set of a CPU is by having the acronyms RISC or CISC, right? And RISC stands for Reduced Instruction Set Computer, and CISC stands for Complex Instruction Set Computer. Okay, so what's the difference? The difference really is that on a RISC CPU, we really only have primitive instructions. Okay, so the arithmetic operations, for example, can only operate on registers. We have instructions to load data, to store data, and logical instructions, arithmetic instructions, and so on. But not so much else, right? So the compiler, or if you write an assembly, you essentially have to write lots and lots of instructions. However, the advantage is that each instruction takes approximately the same time, okay? And the consequence out of this is that it's very, very easy for pipelining, right? If every instruction takes the same time, well, then the different stages might take the same time as well, right? So it's very, very easy for pipelining. However, in the late 80s, people thought, well, yeah, you know, programming with those reduced instruction sets is not very, very convenient. So we really want to have complex instructions, right? So for example, for encryption, decryption, sine, cosine, and what have you, right? So they really offer a rich set of instructions to perform complex tasks, and then the logic inside of the CPU does everything for you. That's the main idea. And the problem there is that we have a big difference in timing for each of the instructions, right? It's obvious that that calculating a sine, the sine function takes way more time than doing a simple addition, right? So if you think of Taylor expansion or something like that, it just takes some time. So this is actually a challenge to perform pipelining then, right? However, modern computers are really CISC instruction sets from the perspective of a programmer, right? So you have lots and lots of instructions available, but the trick, what's being performed is that those instructions are being broken down into so-called microinstructions, from which those complex instructions are built from, right? And those microinstructions then are very easy to pipeline, right? So if you take a modern x86 or Power or ARM CPU, they offer you a rich set of instructions, but due to those microprograms, those microinstructions that are stored inside the CPU, they are able to actually operate as if they were a RISC processor, right? So that means that every modern processor, or well, most modern processors actually do have pipelining, right? Because it's so the advantages of pipelining are just so good. Okay. So much for pipelining. The next big thing in computers is obviously the memory, right? So where to get the data from, and in that perspective, the processor and the memory system really determine first of all the performance and of course the cost of a computer, right? So if you have a processor that operates at, I don't know, 10 gigahertz frequency, right? You probably have to invest a lot into cooling, right? But then it's also very fast, right? The problem, the same goes for memory, right? If you have a computer with terabytes of main memory, you have to invest the money to buy that memory, right? So as always in computer architecture, when building computer systems, you have to find a nice balance between the performance and the cost of a computer. Okay, so the goals are that the memory capacity that you require to run your usual workloads, your usual programs, is sufficient, and the time of access to memory is in order of the speed of the processor. Okay. That means that, taking the example of the 10 gigahertz processor, right? If you have, if you can operate 10 billion instructions per second, right? You better have something available to the processor that the data is there fast enough. Okay. So what does it mean? The situation that we have nowadays is that, that's just some graph, right? This is just some arbitrary performance kind of thing. And the important message is that the performance of modern processors and the performance of the memory system, there's a large gap, right? So the memory just isn't as fast as the processor could process, right? So there's something we need to actually fill this gap here. So in order to fill this gap, I want to introduce the memory hierarchy, okay? And for that, to understand, you you need to realize that there are different kinds of memory, right? So available on computing systems. So first of all, fastest kind of memory are the CPU registers, right? The CPU registers are very close to the core, right? And they can usually be accessed in one clock cycle. Okay, so that's as fast as it can get, right? But the problem with those registers is that they are quite expensive, right? You can't just increase the number of registers without paying a huge additional cost, right? But they are very fast. So that means that they usually have a small size and small capacity, right? The next thing is main memory, right? Which is here in the pyramid, right? It's, fastish. But what you see in between here is the processor cache, which we'll cover this lecture, right? The main memory, the random access memory, is only available when the system is powered on, right? And then after that, we get the hard disk drives, the tape drives or DVD drives, cloud storage, and what have you, right? And it gets slower and slower and slower, obviously, right? And those different memory systems are usually characterized by capacity, access time, and availability, right? And the reason for this multi-stage memory hierarchy is to close the performance gap, right? If you always read and write data from your hard disk, well, then your CPU idles most of the time because it has to wait for the data, right? If you load the data from hard disk to main memory, to the cache, to the registers, then what you have in the registers is where you can operate as fast as possible, right? And
one question: pen drives and it's this type of memory is disk drive, no? You can see that in the
that one here. Yeah. So there's solid state disks probably can be put here, right? So there are new generations of solid state drives which you can put into the PCI Express bus, which is then a little bit slower than main memory, but also larger in capacity. There is a new trend for non-volatile memory. That means it's something like a hard disk, but not quite, but very close to the processor. So, DDR?
Yeah.
That's main memory, yeah.
What does it mean?
DDR is double data rate. That's just a protocol how the communication between the memory controller and the main memory happens. Okay.
What's the cloud storage?
Excuse me?
Cloud storage.
Cloud storage? Oh, I don't know. Do you use Google Drive or Dropbox or something like that? Right, that's cloud storage. Something you have to access over the internet, for example. Okay. So, stupid example. If you search something on the internet, right? It's not like the search query that you have is looking for all the sites when you type in the query. It's that the different results are stored somewhere on the internet, right? And you access those. It's just slower than what you have directly on site. No question. Okay. Okay. Actually, there are tape drives that are way slower than cloud storage. So if you really have archives, they are stored in racks, right? The tapes are stored in racks, and then you have robots picking out the tapes. And yeah, they did an experiment in Africa where they tried to send a few gigabytes of data from the north of Africa to the south. And in parallel, they send a pigeon with a USB stick, right? And actually, the pigeon was faster. So, yeah. So much for that. And if you talk to people who studied in the 60s or 70s, they will tell you that they have really boxes full of sheets, of programmable sheets, which they have to take to the compute center, right? And then those programming cards were then fed into the computer, right? So the memory was on paper actually at one point in time. So yeah. Okay, so what really interests us right now is to actually look at what's going on this part of the pyramid, right? Because that's what we usually focus on when we write computer programs, right? The accessing the disks is a completely different other topic, right? So we will just focus on how to utilize the main memory caches and registers. Okay, so here's a example of a memory hierarchy in a AMD Bulldozer CPU. I don't know if everyone can see it fine. No? Okay. Okay, so better? Slightly, huh? So let's step back here, right? So this is from a tool where you can actually read the so-called topology of a computing system, right? And what you see here is that we have two larger blocks, right? And each of those blocks represent one CPU, right? And they are built, so we have two CPUs in this system, right? Okay, and when we zoom in, so they are both identical, okay? So let's zoom in into one of them. Okay, so what you see here is that they are classified as a NUMA node, right? Each of those two CPUs is classified as one NUMA node, and each of them has one memory controller, right? So we have 8 gigabytes of memory available here, and 8 gigabytes of memory available here, right? So you see they are both identical, right? The next thing is that they both have their own here what's called L3, and then we so you see that the sizes are getting smaller and smaller, right? Here we have 8 megabytes, 2 megabytes, 64 kilobytes, 16 kilobytes, right? So it's getting smaller and smaller, and it's getting spread out more and more over the different cores, right? So at the very bottom we have two cores, right? Each core has its own level one data cache, right? And they share one level one instruction cache and one level two cache, and all of the cores share a level three cache, right? And so the, oh, come on. Something's not right, right? Right, so we actually do have more NUMA domains here. So, if a core, a CPU core here, wants to access, wants to read data, it has to go all the way up in the hierarchy to access the data, right? And the idea is that once you find the data available in one of those caches, right, you can they can serve this data request, this load request or store request, right? So when we have a load, for example, we load a specific address, and we first ask the level one data cache, do you have this address? If yes, then it immediately returns to the processor and serves the data, right? And this level one cache is faster than the level two and faster than the level three and faster than the main memory, obviously, right? And it just has to go up and up and up. And the further down in the hierarchy it finds the data, the faster it can be delivered to the processor, right?
And the data have to pass in each level when you found it, for example. Data in the Numa nodes, in the Numa node, the Numa node have to pass the data to each level.
Yeah. Well, there are different modes of operation.
Because it's a big data, how 16 kilobytes is going to.
Right. Yeah, we will see that, okay? So that's a valid point. So there are special instructions where you can say, please don't go through the caches, right? But that also means that you pay the additional cost that you access main memory, right? Okay. So, but there are use cases where this is beneficial. Okay.
Why there be levels? So instead of that, why there be levels? Level one cache, level two cache, level three cache.
Okay. The level one is the fastest, right? Sure, we could. But the problem then is, how do we make it fast and cheap? Right? Or, well, inexpensive.
Is it that these caches are accessed at different time patterns, or they are accessed at the regular intervals? Like L1 is at 500 milliseconds and L2 is at 1 second of typical time. So that you can manage the time in accessing the data, or how is it?
We'll get to that, hopefully. Okay, so the reason why caches work actually is some people might disagree there, but the idea is that as a programmer, you don't directly program the caches, right? You just access memory, right? And the caches handle everything for you, okay? So about the timing, right? So as I said, the registers are usually can usually be accessed in one clock cycle, right? And the capacity for those are between 256 to 1 kilobytes, right? So depending on the machine, then we have the different caches, right? Here we have two levels, right? And you see that they have different access times, right? So the primary cache can be accessed depending on the actual architecture between 1 and 3 clock cycles, right? The secondary cache between 3 and 6, so it's getting orders of the timing's double, and the main memory then is at 25 to 40 clock cycles, or even hundred clock cycles, right? So that's the reason why we have multiple caches, right? If we had one very big cache, so the secondary cache would be, well, bigger, right? So we have to pay more in terms of hardware resources or time to actually make it fast, right? And there's another reason for that. If you look at this topology again, so when you write multi-threaded programs, for example, right, at one point in time, they might need to communicate with each other, right? And the communication between, for example, those two, right, can be done by leveraging the level two cache, right, which is then very fast, right? The communication between this and this can be done over the level three cache, right? And by dividing the last level cache into multiple sections, you can actually achieve better performance if only one core or two cores in that example accesses those caches. We'll see why. Okay. Okay. Any other questions?
What will be the difference between background memory and archive memory as well? Archive is like having it in the web or something?
Well, it could be on the web, it could be on tapes.
So for example, if you have it in your computer as a SSD or a HDD.
Yeah, that's not archive memory. HDD or SDD could be considered as background memory, right? Yeah. But archive memory really means that you store it somewhere, and the facility where you store it actually guarantees you that the data is still there in 50 years, right? So one colleague actually told me she wrote their dissertation in the 70s, right? And she accessed the archive, right? And it's still there. She could still read it, right? And so, that's more or less the difference. Okay. Yeah.
So, can you consider AWS archive memory?
Hmm?
AWS, Amazon Web Services.
No, it's not archive memory. It's somewhere in between background memory and archive memory. So it's, I don't know what the access times are there. But it's not really backed up, right? Usually, at least not to the extent of the archive memory.
So any examples
of archive memory? Tape storage, those tape robots.
In the modern days, we use tapes.
Yes.
Or the mainframe?
Almost any facility there is that has to handle huge amount of data. Okay. No. It's just the most reliable and cheapest way to actually archive data, right? So it's because why not, right? Yeah. It's not a bad technology. And as said, it's reliable, right? Yeah. I don't know if you still have a floppy disk available, right? Try to read it. Okay. See? No. Your CD-ROMs, for example, or DVDs, they decay over time as well, right? Your hard disk drive is especially vulnerable to any physical damage, right? The magnets tear off, right? The solid state disks, well, yeah, we don't know yet how long they will last, right? But approximately a few million read and write cycles. Or well, not a few million, a few billion maybe, but then they will die, right? It's just not reliable. There is no better reliable technology. If you look at history, the best technology to actually preserve knowledge is still stone, right? So. Yeah, it's not that bad. Okay. Right. So, back to topic. To what we want to achieve with the caches is to really close the performance gap between the very fast processors and the slowish memory, right? So as I mentioned, the main idea between the regular caches is that they are transparent. Okay, there is a trend to offer more and more programmable caches. Well, they aren't called caches, but more scratch pads or something, local scratch pads. The main idea of the caches, however, is that they are organized in blocks of neighboring data, okay, which we call a cache line. We have different strategies to actually identify whether a data is in the cache or not. We have different strategies where to place the data, and we have different strategies to replace data. Okay, the replacement is especially interesting because, as I mentioned, the sizes, the capacity of the caches get smaller and smaller, right? That means that you can't fit everything into your last level cache. That means that you eventually have to replace something. Okay. If you need more information about this whole computer architecture and organization, you can read up William Stalling's Computer Organization and Architecture. Okay. You can probably get it in the library, and if you search for it on the internet. Okay. Right, so how do we get from main memory to the cache line? How do we organize it? Okay, so if we look at the main memory, getting back to the von Neumann architecture, right? We have the sequential and continuous block of memory with the memory address starting at zero up to some size, right? So when we look at one cache line, we can when we access data, right, we read an entire cache line. That means that we are able to put k words into one cache line, right? So if if we have this cache here, right, where we have different numbers for the different line, then we need to be able to store k words into that cache line. Okay. So usually the cache lines are between 64 and 128 bytes. Okay. Right. The tag is there to identify the cache line, but we will get to that. Is this clear? Because that's very important, right? If you have an address, right, in your main memory, that's usually mapped to a cache line, right? And when you load something, you always transfer an entire cache line, right, which you can then access in the cache. Okay. There is no smaller granularity. Okay. So the location of the cache is usually between the CPU and the main memory, right? Again, to repeat it, the access time between the CPU and the caches is very fast, right? And the granularity of data transfers between the CPU and the cache is word-wise, right? So we have one word, right? An entire block of k words gets stored into the cache line. When we request data, we access one word from the cache line. Okay. If we request data that's not in the cache, we transfer an entire block of memory back to the cache. Okay. The reason for that is that the setup time, etc., to transfer from the cache from the main memory to the cache is high enough that it's actually worth it to transfer more data than just byte by byte. Okay, so the whole protocol to transfer the data allows us to more efficiently transfer multiple bytes than one byte, right? We just get a higher bandwidth. Okay, so that will be an example for a single cache. This is an example for a three-level cache organization, right? Where we get from CPU to the last level cache being the fastest, fast, less fast, slow, right? And usually the closer some memory system is to the CPU, the faster it is, but also the smaller it is, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So here we have word length of the memory address is defined with a set of serials from 0 to some number, and we have the data stored in word length for each one, and the block K is a complete set for one cache serial number, say C0. That means it represents from memory address 0 to memory address 10. So that belongs to cache number 1.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how it is assigned.
Mm-hmm.
And is it a significant number that the cache has memory address from 0 to 16 and then 17 to 31? So it's like that?
That will never happen, no.
Okay.
No. So let me give you an example. So let's see. So let's say we load address 0. Okay. So let's say we can store 16 words in the cache. Okay.
Yes.
So one cache line is 16 words.
Yes.
Okay. So let's say we load 0. Right. That means that we transfer what's in the cache then. Is from address 0 to 15. So, right. Okay. So, next is to load, 2. Address 2. Okay. Address 2. By some means, we can identify that, okay, we have address 0, address 1. Address 2, it's already in the cache, so we can transfer the word from here, right? So let's, as an example, load address 20. Okay. So what's happening is that, or what's not happening is that we will get a cache line starting at 20 up until 35, right? That's not what's happening, right? What's happening is that we take the we load from address 16 to 31, right? And somewhere in between we have the address 20, right? So we will the cache will always load in so-called cache-aligned blocks, right? So that way we can easily identify that we don't have any overlappings, right? So if we load at address 20, we always have to check for overlappings, which would be bad, right? Or more expensive.
So is it like that the cache number segment is from 0 to 15? Is it a arbitrary value, or it could be vary from processor to processor, or how is it? Means because if we say a set of blocks from 0 to 15, then it's it could be 0 to 31 also.
It could be 0 to 31 also, yeah. That depends on the specification of the cache, right? So if you have If you have a cache line that's 32 words big, then you would have, for example, 0 to 32. But I hope I'll be able to answer it in the next few slides more more clear. Okay. Okay. So, due to this effect that we always load one entire cache line, right? What we, in order to really utilize this fast cache memory as best as possible, what we have to look out for in our programs when we write programs is that we have locality of our data accesses. Okay, we have two kinds of locality there. One is the temporal locality and the other is the spatial locality. Okay, temporal locality means that if we have a loop, for example, right, which is, well, yeah, so let's say we have a loop, right, which goes from 0 to some number, right, and let's say we that's a bad example. Let's look at the registers as if they were caches, right? So let's say we have some number where we always accumulate stuff onto, right? That variable has to correspond to some memory location, right? Eventually. And that means that in this loop, right, we can assume that A is always in one of the faster memory systems, right? Either in the cache or in the register or whatever, right? So this is temporal locality, right? Where we can reuse this, where we reuse the same data over and over again, right? Spatial locality is when we have an array, for example. So we want to sum up all the elements of an array, right? So we want I to go from, I don't know, pseudocode. We want to have I going from 0 to n, right? We have an array that's n elements big, n plus one elements big, right? And that array is usually stored in some sequential memory, right? This would be B0, B1, to Bn, okay? So it starts at some address. Let's say A0 to An plus one here. And what you notice is that A0 has some specific value. A1 is just A0 plus the word length of B, right? So it's exactly that pattern, right? If we load A0, what we can assume is that A1 is already in the cache. In some limit, right? So this is what spatial locality means then, right?
Why is this n plus one?
Because it's here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it points one to the last. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. This would be Okay. This means that we only have to access main memory if we assume we have k words as a cache line, we only have to access main memory every kth time, right? Which is a big improvement if we compared to if we have to access main memory all the time, right? This is spatial locality. Okay. Okay, and this diagram here is the, so if we have the full address range from 0 to 2 to the power of n minus 1, we have a specific probability to access specific regions of our main memory during the runtime of our program. Yeah. This is what this graph is showing. Okay. Good. So, let's get to how the caches are organized, right? So how we place the different cache lines into the into our cache, and how we identify when we get some arbitrary address. Okay. So for that, we have when we access the cache, it's either successful or it failed, right? So the control unit, the cache controller, checks if the data is inside of the cache by using the memory address. And if it's available, we call it a hit. Then the data is read from the cache. If it's not available, we call it a miss. Then we read the block of words from the next level, copy it to our cache, and return the required data. And the cache organization in total solves the two things. One is the placement problem, in which cache line is a memory block stored? The identification problem, how to find the required data or block inside of the cache. Okay. So we know three forms for the cache organization. One is the direct mapping, the other is the full associative mapping, and then we have the N-way associative mapping. Okay, let's dive into the direct mapping first. Okay, if we look at our main memory here, right, we have some data here at address 1, another data here at address 5, and so on and so forth, right? And those, well, blocks of memory need to be mapped onto the cache, right? And what we do here is that we use a modulo operation, right, where we take the address that we want to access. This is the address that we want to access. This is the number of cache lines that we have available, right? And we take the modulo of the address by n, right? And then we have the cache line address where we want where the data is stored. Okay. So far, so good. Great. So. That means that each main memory block is assigned exactly to one specific cache line, right? So going back to that example, if we actually would, let's go one back, okay. So, let's look at it. So if we look at the first M blocks of our main memory, right? Those are directly mapped to the entire cache. Okay, and the next block are mapped to the exact same cache lines. Okay. So this is the sequence of numbers which map to a specific cache line. Okay, the way how it's implemented is then very, very simple, right? So we have the memory address, okay, and we partition the memory address into one tag, then the cache line, and then the word inside of our cache line, right? So remember, we have a different number of elements in the cache line, right? And we still want to get one word out of the cache line still, right? So we have the word index here, we have the line index here, and the tag here, right? So what we then do is we select the cache line, right? So it can go either here or here or here. Then we take the tag, which is stored in the cache line, right? Compare it to the tag of our memory address. If those match, then we have a hit in the cache, right? And then we can actually select the word that we want to access. If those tags don't match, we have a miss, and we have to go to main memory in that specific example. Okay. Once again? Okay, so. Excuse me? Right. So here we have one memory address, right? And so if you remember from the first lecture, everything's stored in binary, right? So I don't know. I would like to postpone that question, because I have a slide for that, how the addresses are split up in more detail. So back to your question, to repeat it. So we have our memory address, right, which is some number, and we split it up. First we have a tag, then we have the line, and then we have the word index which we want to access. Okay. The tag is unique, right? So no two memory blocks have the same tag. Okay. Then we have the line, which is not unique, which maps to exactly one of those cache lines, right? So we select the line, which is direct. So this line here is the result of the modulo operation, so to say. And with this line, we can directly address the correct cache line, right? Where we can read the tag. Okay, and in order for the tag, in order to see whether the requested address is in the cache or not, the tags have to match, right? And only if the tags match, we are able to select the correct word from the cache line. Okay.
The tag is just for the block of memory, for the block of lines. So when you got the line, that in that specific line has to be the word, no?
If the tag match, yeah.
Because the thing is that you are like, because I don't know if it's random or what, but the thing is that you are pointing as a word as a different line in the memory. You know, you see the image. That is like that or not?
No. So we have the address, right? We have sequential addresses, right? And the first few bits are the tag, okay? So
the line is a specific location of the stack of the cache.
The line corresponds to a specific cache line in our cache.
So in that cache line have to be the word.
In that cache line has to be the word, right? Yeah. And it's the word.
The image, so it's a little wrong, because it's saying that you are seeing one cache line and you're getting the word for another line.
No. So this is our entire cache line, Okay, so I agree that the image is a little bit confusing. Okay, so let me go through it again. So we have what we have here is our entire cache line, right? Which has some index, right? We have 0 to m-1 cache lines, right? The part of our memory address, which is the line, right, points to exactly one of those cache lines, right? What we store in the cache line is not only the data that we are looking for, right, but also the tag of our address. Okay, the tag is the unique identifier in that sense, right? So what we have here is then an index into the cache line, right? So depending on the number of cache lines, it needs that and that many bits, right? So if we have 4 cache lines, we need to have exactly 2 bits, right? Because 2 bits are able to represent 4 numbers, right? I will get the data from exactly that word that I want to access. Yeah. So what's not in the picture is actually the data path where the data is stored back to the CPU. Right. It's just how we select. Right. So this is a comparison, and this here is a gate, so to say, which only opens if we have a match here. Right. Similar to that one. That one only opens if we have no match, right? So we either get the data from the main memory or from the cache line. Okay. Let's try it with a even more confusing picture, shall we?
If the tag doesn't match, then how will we find the word?
If the tag doesn't match, that means it's not in the cache. That means we have to go one level further down, right? And in that picture, that would be the main memory, right? So, in the main memory, we just have our memory address, right? And this is hopefully unique, right? So we can just point to the right byte. Inside of our, to the right word in our main memory. Okay. You still had a question, right? Does this answer your question? Do you still have a question?
Yeah, the thing is that what I'm feeling is that the image is wrong. Because you cannot go in a different line from the line you're pointing. If your point is that the first line, you have to get the word of the first line, not the third.
Okay, so so if I understand correctly, what you mean is if I had a different memory address, then I would go, for example, to that line, right?
No, the thing is that I'm not sure if I'm missing some information or what, but the thing is that when you say line, I get the line as only one block, not a group of blocks, just one.
Yeah.
And that's right or wrong?
That's correct.
I
sure.
That block, that 4 blocks, is one line.
It's one line.
See, L0 is one part and it has one tag. L1, 4 blocks are one line and one tag.
Okay.
And those blocks are words. So it's pointing to the particular word. But the whole block is
on there.
Okay.
Now,
thank you.
Clear now?
Yeah.
Okay. Excellent. Thanks.
Another question.
Yeah.
The tag represents L0 or LI?
No. No, the tag is the unique tag, right? So if we have, So if we have our main memory, let's say we start at, now I'm writing in hexadecimal numbers. Okay, I hope that's fine. Okay. Right. So okay. So we have our memory blocks, right? So let's say the first four bytes are our tag. Okay, that means that we would get Cyrix 1, 2, 3, and so on and so forth, right? Let's say we have 16 cache lines. Okay, that means that we need another four bytes to actually represent the index of the word. Right? That would go at the end. One cache line is 16 words long. Okay, and then if we would have another 16 cache lines in total, that would mean that we have here. That would be the line, okay. That would and then we would have the last bit as the word, right? Okay. So this means we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc., and so on. Right, and the next cache block here is 0x11. Let's leave it as W here, right? Because it's not important. And the next cache line would be 0x12, right? Up until need to write smaller. Okay. So we have 0x11, 0x12, up until 0x1f. Okay. Right. The next number here would be 0x2. Right? So we count on, right? So we have a unique tag, right? But multiple cache lines, right?
Yeah, but the entire block is represented here in this picture through A0, LE, and address.
Right.
The entire block is represented by the tag, right? So.
No, the tag is there to identify whether we have whether the block we stored in the cache line is what we are looking for.
Oh, okay.
Right. So in that example, right, if we do a load 0x110, okay, that would mean that we have the tag 0, right? The line, tag 1, line 1, and word 0, right? If we then, I need to get a bigger chalk. If we then do a load 0x112, right? We get into the same cache line, right? Just a different word.
Yeah, 110.
Right? Okay. If we then do a load 0x, A13. Right, we have a tag here of A or 10, right, in decimal. But the line number is 1 here, right? So what's stored in that picture at line 1? So L1 prior to this loading would have as the tag 1, and then 0 to F words here, right? Right. So when we want to load the word from that address here, right, we look into line one, right, because that's our line index. We compare the tags, right, and then we see one is not equal to A, right. That means that the data that's being held in that cache line is not the data that we want to load here. Okay. So I think that's more or less what's in that picture here, right? And now we have, I think, 32 bits of 32-bit address space, right? And what we see here is that we have 2 bytes for the tag, right? Going from 0 to FF, okay, so all ones, right? And then we have the line and the word, right? And the word here is 2 bits. That means that we have 4 cache lines. Sorry, not cache lines. Each cache line has 4 words, right? And that's then how we access the caches, right? Okay. It's more or less the same thing as we had on the board. Okay. Okay. Question? Okay. Right.
So the data is 32 bits long, or is the main memory address with the data 32 bits?
No, the data is 32 bits.
Okay.
So
the address before is 24 bits.
Is it 24 bits? My bad. So we have 8 bits of text, 14 bits of for the lines, and 2 bits for the word. Yeah. Yeah. And 2^14 is 16,386. Okay. All right. All clear? If you understand direct mapping caches, then the associative caches are easy. No. Okay, let's see. So as a summary, what we have with direct mapping is that we have a simple address determination, right? It's very cost effective, right? If we look at this schematic here, right? We don't have to put a lot of hardware to actually build this cache, right? It's not a lot of logic that needs to go into there, right? We can directly index the cache line. We only have one comparator, essentially, right? We only have to select the correct cache line, then compare the tag, and we are done, right? So very, very simple, very cost-effective, okay? Yeah, I won't repeat the different characteristics here. The problem, however, is with the direct mapping. I don't know if you noticed. If we have blocks of memory, if we have a bad enough access pattern, then we evict our cache lines all the time, essentially, right? We have a lot of cache misses, right? So. So that might be very, very bad. In order to avoid this, let me introduce you to the full associative mapping. Okay, full associative mapping means that each address of the main memory block can be mapped to any arbitrary cache block. Okay. So that means that if we go to that example where we have, I don't know, let's say we have four cache lines available, right? Each of them is on a different cache line, right? Then we load one cache line, load the second cache line, load the third cache line, right? And they all fit into the cache, and we don't have any conflicts between the line, right? We can just map it arbitrarily to any of the cache lines. Right, so problem is, how do we find where we put the data in, right? For that, yeah. So the idea really is that any block of main memory can map to any cache line that's available. Right.
What if there is no available? How do we decide which line in the cache we put back and make free room?
Okay. That's a few slides in the future. Okay. Right. So the problem with that, however, is that in order to look up if our memory address is in the cache, we now have to compare every tag. Right. The nice thing, though, is that now our memory address is only split into tag and word. Right. So the word still indexes the actual word in the cache line, right? And the tag now identifies the different cache line, right? So getting back to the question about the sizes and the effectiveness, etc., of the caches, and why we might want to have smaller caches, right? But faster ones, right? So if you look at this block diagram, right? So depending on the number of cache lines we have here, right? When we want to look up if a memory address is inside of the cache or not, we have to compare each and every tag, right? And in that picture, it's just that we have a multitude of inputs to this comparator, right? But the big problem is that the bigger those comparison operators get, right, the more costly they are, and the longer it takes to actually get to a result whether the comparison is true or not, right? Okay. It's like the previous one, right? So if you compare here, so we have one tag. So now now the tag determines whether it's in the cache or not, right?
So it skips the line part entirely.
Yeah. So this is just for lookup, right? If it's not in the cache and we have to and if you want to put in the cache, we just find the next free slot. Okay. But then we have to compare each and every tag when we want to look it up. Okay. So I'd say that this is the most efficient way to deal with the issue of the direct mapping, right? Where we have the conflicts between addresses. Right. The only conflict that we get here is that our cache gets full and we need to get a new data set in, right? As you said. Yeah. But if you look at this accumulation example, right? If you go to the direct mapping case, then what you might see is that if the array is big enough, that you get conflicting cache line accesses, right? And you have to evict the data even though it wouldn't be necessary. So this is a little bit of a contrived example. I have a better example later on, right? But on the other hand, if you take the full associative caches, right, you just go through the array and find whether there's some free slot, right? And give a little peek preview in this specific example, what you could do best is, well, you just look at the access time to some extent of the cache lines, right? And you put the new data into the cache line that has been used the least frequent, or that's most in the past, right? Okay. So again, this picture, I hope it's clear now. So we can just place the our cache lines into arbitrary we can just place the data into arbitrary cache lines. Good. Any question to the full associative mapping? I hope you understood it better now that you got the direct mapping. Hopefully, yeah.
I don't know what the word is used for what. The word is used for what? For two bits word.
That's used to identify the slot of the word that we want to use in the very same way that we had for the direct mapping. Okay. Okay. So what we don't have here in this picture is that we should need another column for the second data entry, right? Because we have three columns, actually, because we have two bits for the word, right? That means that we can address four words in our cache line. So. Okay. All right. So summary again, the lookup for the full associative mapping is very expensive. You need n comparisons to find an entry. Other than that, it's also the splitting of the address is also not very, very complicated. Okay. So the question now is whether we can find a middle ground between the direct mapping and the full associative mapping. Right, in terms of cost and effectiveness and efficiency. Okay, and for that, we have the K-way associative mapping. Okay, that means that each main memory block is directly mapped into a set of fully associative sets. Okay, so we have, in this example, we have four sets, right? And Each main memory block is now directly mapped onto one of those sets, okay? And then inside the set, we have a full associative placement, okay? So this means that to figure out where in the set, in which set we are, directly corresponds to the direct mapping, which is very cheap, right? And then we have our sets, which have K entries, which is K-way fully associative, right? And we can have the benefits of the full associative mapping, right? So, getting back to this picture where the different blocks can be placed. So this is those are the first V blocks of main memory, where the V stands for the sets, right? And if we take the first block, it maps to the first set, right? And in each set, we have k cache lines, which are then fully associative mapped. Okay. Right. So this is now a combination, right? The tag that we have here. So this is a similar splitting of the memory address that we had for the direct mapping, right? But now we don't have the line in the cache, but we have the set that we need to look at, right? So we choose the full set, right? And out of this set, we take the tags and compare it to our tag, right? And only if the tag matches, then we have a hit in the cache and we can read the specific word inside of our cache line that we found. Okay. Yeah. Okay, a block. So a block in this example is that we have the block of memory is what is being mapped into one cache line, okay? And then we have V blocks, right? So V cache lines, if we take the block in main memory, which is placed at BV, right? So this is going to be mapped into the same cache line. Into the same set.
So is it like we have the main memory that is divided into blocks,
right?
And that block is divided into sets.
Yes. Map to sets. It maps to sets. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Right. So back to our very complicated diagram, right, where we have our 24-bit address. Then we have a tag of 9 bits and a set of 13 bits. So this would be a... come on. I think it's a four-way associative map, but I'm not sure at the moment. Anyways, do you get the idea? Any questions still? Then we can work through it. Okay. All right. So the summary of the k-way associative mapping is that, of course, we have a less expensive lookup, so we only need to have k comparisons to find a tag. And the nice way is that the nice thing about the k-way associative mapping is that it's really the generalization of the two forms that we had before, right? If we have a one-way associative mapping, then we have the direct mapping. If we have our k equal to n, then we have the full associative mapping, right? That means that the number of cache lines in one set is equal to the number of cache lines available, right? And this lowers the probability for conflict situations. So in current processes, we usually have eight-way associativity at the last level cache, and then it's being reduced and reduced and reduced. So one example is the Knight's Landing processor, which has a high bandwidth memory attached to the core, and that can be used as the level 4 cache. Okay, so directly before the main memory, and that's implemented as a direct mapped cache, right? Mainly because it's just very huge, right? And by having it very huge, you reduce the probability for conflict situations. Okay, so All right. So looking at the performance of some arbitrary benchmark with the different cache sizes and the different organization forms. So we have direct, two-way, four-way, eight-way, 16-way. Okay, for this specific benchmark, it's very interesting to note that once you reach a certain cache size, right, it doesn't matter if you are 4, 8, or 16-way, right? The hit ratio of your cache is pretty high, right? And if the hit ratio of your cache is pretty high, that means that you don't access your main memory or the next level as frequent as you could, right? So that's the reason why most of the time it's just not worth it to implement more than 8-way associativity for the usual workloads that benefit from caching, right? There are specific programs and applications that don't benefit from caching, no matter how big the cache are, no matter how big and no matter how many associativity there is in the cache, right? Because they just jump randomly through main memory, right? So you can't help it. One example is database queries, usually. Okay. Right. So to the replacement strategies, just real quick for the I will repeat it next time again, just to close the circle. So if our associativity set is full, then that means that we need to place another cache line into our cache. That means that we somehow have to replace it, right? In direct mapping, that's pretty clear, right? There's really no choice that we can implement, right? For the associative caches, however, it's a little different. So what we have is least recently used, least frequently used, first in, first out, or more or less random. Okay, so least recently used means that we have some information about the age of the data in the cache. Least frequently used means that we count the access, the number of accesses. First in, first out means whatever came in first gets out first. So no matter how old or how frequently it's being used. Pseudorandom means that, we just pick whatever, right? And it's very interesting that the pseudorandom actually gives pretty decent results, right? And if,
what is the standard method that's used for the replacement?
None of those. It's a very well kept secret by the implementers of the processor. No. If you look at the press release of the Ryzen CPU, for example, they said, we have a artificial intelligence for our cache replacement strategy. Okay, so it's something. To be honest, I don't know exactly. There are groups that try to figure it out. There are probably papers about it. But the closest I think is least recently used. Okay. And the biggest problem here is that, the biggest challenge is to actually make either of those very efficient, right? You probably don't want to take the time each time you access a cache line, right? You have to make it fast as well. So you always have some some drawbacks and cutoffs and shortcuts, etc. So yeah, it's very, very complicated. But just for the sake of completeness. Okay. Okay, let's close here.